From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We've talked a lot about how emotion itself can act like a contagion. Panic spreads quickly, but so can joy. So what about hope? Especially in the darkness of a disaster, can hope be that thread of light on the horizon that all of us can see? Well, our guest today says yes. Writer, historian, and activist Rebecca Solnit recently said, quote, "I came to the idea of hope as an activist and as a writer of history, seeing that things were better than we were often told, that actually ordinary people can have a great deal of power and often succeed in using it in ways that change the world for the better." So, of course, we wondered, can that hope burst forth even in a global pandemic, which is a unique kind of disaster that's both global and very intimate at the same time? Well, Rebecca's two previous books, A Paradise Built in Hell and Hope in the Dark, explore this positive possibility head on. She's also recently out with a new memoir called Recollections of My Non-Existence. And Rebecca Solnit joins us today from San Francisco. Rebecca, welcome to On Point.
Lovely to be here. Hello to you.
Hello to you. And it is so great to have you. And first of all, I just want to ask, San Francisco and much of California was sort of out ahead of the rest of the country in terms of lockdown. So you've been in this longer than the rest of us have. How are you doing?
You know, I am appreciating things that were really ordinary before. But I'm good. And I have to say, you know, I'm a writer who's been working at home for more than 30 years. My life is so much less disrupted than almost anyone's. So I feel a lot more for people whose lives have changed a lot more, who are financially precarious, who are trying to homeschool kids who they did not expect to spend 24/7 with all of a sudden. People who don't have homes, all those kinds of people who are all around me right now.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I feel like those are the folks who I very much want them to hear what you have to say today, Rebecca. And full disclosure, I recently heard or reheard a podcast from On Being where Krista Tippett interviewed you. They sort of put it back up at the top of their podcast feed a couple of weeks ago. And in that interview, you said you could talk about hope until the cows came home. And I thought, I need to hear more about that right now. So what is it about hope that that you've turned so much of your emotional and mental attention to over the past several years?
You know, it really began with my response to the outbreak of the war against Iraq in 2003. But what I call hope is really just full recognition of the unpredictability of the future, because both pessimists and optimists join forces in assuming they know what's going to happen next and that it requires nothing of us. My vision of hope is a sense of radical uncertainty with the possibility of intervention to shape the future. And in disasters, there's always a power struggle. We're seeing authoritarians all over the world seize more power. Hungary just became a dictatorship effectively. Mm. We're seeing power grabs in our own country and the Philippines, et cetera. But we also see mutual aid and political struggles and crises that often discredit the ruling powers, show people a kind of fearlessness, power from below, and possibility for radical change that can also shape the outcome.
Yeah.
And we've seen that in many cases as well in the wake of disasters.
Well, I want to go back to a thing that you just said a minute ago, because there's so much contained in virtually every sentence that you utter, but this one in particular, when you said we should recognize hope as a radical acceptance of uncertainty with the possibility that we could intervene. It's that second half that I want to explore with you a little bit, because there's no guarantee that the intervention would be positive, as you said. But I don't think people often enough recognize that that possibility of positive intervention is there. We're just sort of clouded by our concern and fear of the uncertainty.
Yeah, no, and we live in a country and a culture that enthusiastically de-emphasizes the power of ordinary people over and over and over again, you know, tells the story of Rosa Parks as a tired lady who sat down on a bus rather than a brilliant political organizer who catalyzed a movement she was committed to. And we like to tell the story that the power all rests in the hands of the officially powerful. But it's more complicated than that. So, and then a habit I think that's common to human beings all over is wanting to know what's going to happen. And that often means that we accept as inevitable what the future is going to look like. And that gets us off the hook. Because what I found when I started talking about hope in the wake of that outbreak of war 17 years ago this month is that a lot of people didn't want hope because it saddled them with responsibility. If we could determine the outcome, we better get to work. We better recognize the nature of our power. And I've found a lot of desperate people, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, the Zapatistas, et cetera, are actually often very hopeful because alternative to them is truly terrible. For a lot of more comfortable people, the alternative is binge-watching shows and, you know, eating snacks on the couch and complaining.
You know,
that is comfortable in its own way.
Yeah, well, so when you're talking about alternatives, I mean, to me, one of the things that really defines us as human is this capacity to hope, right? It is actually a common thread amongst all 7.8 billion of us. I was just thinking this morning about how, for example, Dante in the Inferno, when you enter the Inferno, what's the last sign that you see? Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. So it's like the last thing that you have left that you must abandon for you to descend down into hell. It just seems like the indefatigable desire to hope is something that actually binds us all. And you say no more so than in the midst of a disaster.
In some ways. And what I found, and it began as I was researching for the 100th anniversary of the 1906 earthquake here in San Francisco. And what I found corresponded to my own experience of the 1989 earthquake, that there had been not only an extraordinary upwelling of ordinary people reaching out to do what needed to be done to take care of each other, but in that, an incredible sense of joy and power and connection that was missing in everyday life. And one thing even the largest disaster sometimes illuminates is the ways in which everyday life can also be a kind of disaster of alienation, mm-hmm. meaninglessness, powerlessness, a sense that people don't have the connections and meaningful work, meaningful roles that they really yearn for. And, you know, disasters are first of all horrible, and I have never wished, oh, now we should have a disaster because all these good things happen. But even though I wish there wasn't a pandemic, even though I wish these things didn't happen, they do happen. And recognizing the radical social reorganization within them, which often scares the socks off the powers that be, is really important, as is recognizing that panic and looting are not actually widespread mm-hmm. common responses.
Yeah.
Well, and within that is a whole different sense of human nature than the ones we're commonly given.
And that,
which we're told that, yeah, sorry.
I don't mean to interrupt, because that's exactly what I want to explore with you. And that possibility is really sort of touched a lot of our listeners, because when we put a call out just the other day for folks to send us their questions or reflections on hope in the midst of the pandemic, we got several responses. And just listen for a moment to what Andrea from West Roxbury, Massachusetts told us in this voicemail.
Am I delusional and in denial to feel not despair but hopeful? Is it like the lies people tell themselves when they march off to war? Yes, those who die, of course, and the frontline healthcare and grocery workers are bearing the biggest pain and sacrifice of this harm. But for the rest of us, it feels to me like a bright, shining light on exactly what and how much we need to change together and only together in order to survive individually, a forced opportunity.
That's Andrea from West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Rebecca Solnit, is she on to something?
I think forced opportunity is an extraordinarily smart way of framing it, because these are not things we would choose, but suddenly they're with us, and within them, there are real possibilities to connect in different ways. There's a way that the old stabilities break up, and that can be terrifying when you see systemic failure, government failure, institutional failure, inadequate medical supplies and protective gear, in these cases, the financial emergency so many are facing. But there's also the possibility of radical change, because many of these things, financial desperation and inequality and, you know, callous and selfish government, were already with us. And now we're looking at them in a kind of stark new light. And there is a real possibility of change. Disasters shake things loose. And the things that we regarded as fixed and unchangeable can suddenly be changed. It's been fascinating seeing people in power suddenly say, well, actually, we can put all these homeless people up in hotels. Actually, we can change unemployment insurance and sick leave. Actually, we can find $3 trillion to throw at a problem. You know, the sense that suddenly everything can be profoundly different because something terrible has happened does remind us that everything can be profoundly different, maybe even not just because something terrible has happened. The powerful are often scrambling to restore a status quo that worked very well for them. The less powerful are often saying, wow, everything has changed. We're not ready to change it all back.
Yeah. Well, you've written that human nature in a disaster is resilient, resourceful, generous, empathetic, brave. Of course, the question is it human nature in that moment, or is it something fundamental that we can carry with us after that disaster? So, Rebecca, there's a lot more that I'm looking forward to talking with you after we come back from a quick break. We're talking this hour with writer, historian, and activist Rebecca Solnit about hope in the midst of a global pandemic. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about hope in the middle of a disaster, and particularly in the midst of the global pandemic that the world is undergoing together at the moment. And I'm joined today by Rebecca Solnit. She's a writer, historian, and activist, author of more than 20 books on everything from feminism to Western history, social power, and change. Her latest book is a memoir titled Recollections of My Non-Existence. She's also previously written a couple of books about hope in the middle of disasters, including A Paradise Built in Hell and Hope in the Dark. And she joins us today from San Francisco via Skype. Now, Rebecca, you mentioned the 1906 earthquake that destroyed the city of San Francisco, and how there are many lessons to be learned from that. In your book, A Paradise Built in Hell, you spend a lot of time talking about how the response at the level of individual citizens or residents isn't something that was as well documented or discussed as sort of the destruction that laid waste to San Francisco. So what was the citizen level response then?
And one quick note is that the earthquake did damage a lot of structures. Uh-huh. The firestorm that followed,
that's
which was partly caused by breaking gas mains, but also by institutional incompetence and arrogance, destroyed a lot more.
Yeah.
The disaster sociologists I talked to like to say there's no such thing as a natural disaster, as we can see with this pandemic, in which, yes, there's a virus and that's not human-made, but how we have planned for and responded to it, allocated resources, mm-hmm. is everything. But what I first really saw clearly in the 1906 earthquake, and then looked around for and found in 9/11, even in Hurricane Katrina, in which institutional authority was so malignant, was that indeed ordinary people are altruistic, generous, resourceful, creative, brave, deeply empathic with other impacted people. They suddenly have everything in common with. And that so is not just, that is definitely who we are in emergencies and crises. But what's interesting about it is not just that we're really good in these moments, but this extraordinary joy I've found in people surviving the worst things that ever happened to them, surrounded by death and destruction. That joy of somehow being who they were meant to be and connected in the ways they were meant to be connected. In some ways, you can see a kind of market-driven, advertising-driven commercial society as a scheme to keep us all apart and miserable, because that makes us good consumers and bad citizens, whereas a disaster makes us bad consumers and good citizens. And so what's really interesting is the question of, well, why aren't we like that all the time? Yeah. What happens? And we are to some extent. And one of the things I came to understand writing this book is that volunteerism, altruism, donations, charitable work, this kind of organizing actually holds our society together in a lot of ways. And you can see it at levels as small as the family. And if you ask people, they say, oh, we are a capitalist society, but parents don't invoice their children for the pleasure of being raised by them. Friends don't listen to your problems and send you a bill for the billable hours of it. You know, that there is a huge amount of this going on we don't really take stock of, but we're not told that this is who we are. And as recently as this morning, I saw somebody say that we're basically selfish and cowardly, and with that misinterpretation of Darwinism we've been cursed with for 150 years. And in fact, what actually has always made us survive is mutual aid. You know, we survive as groups, not as individuals. We survive because our mothers took care of us during those years when we were helpless. Mm-hmm. We survive because people take care of the systems that help us survive. And as we often also find, even when there's really corrupt people at the top, there's a lot of everyday administrators. We're now seeing it with medical people who are passionately committed to serving the public good. But if we don't frame it that way, we don't celebrate it, we don't see it, we don't emphasize it in the stories we tell, because every disaster and everyday life is always a battle about the story we're going to tell. Who are we? What matters? Who should be in charge? Who should we trust? What is human nature? And at the bottom of disasters is this extraordinary vision of a kind of human nature let loose. When there are no rules and no bosses, who are we? And we're not the marauding, hoarding, panicking, pillaging mobs we've seen in disaster movies, the ones that necessitate Tom Cruise and Charlton Heston. Mm-hmm. We're actually kind of awesome. And then it's like, what would it look like if we could make room for that and recognize that in everyday life, which is itself a kind of disaster, right, as I was saying, of alienation and isolation and kind of a devaluation and degradation of human life when it gets really commercial and banal and you know, driven by, you know, the worst among us.
Right. Well, you know, Rebecca, you're in talking about sort of the narrative that emerges around a disaster, and, you know, it emerges even as fast as ever, given modern technology. I mean, you've mentioned Hurricane Katrina a couple times. I think we did see that the narrative that was being played out was disconnected from the reality that people in New Orleans were actually experiencing. I mean, you spent a lot of time writing about that. Can you tell us, remind us about what exactly happened?
Yeah, the mainstream media colluded in a government story that is actually really common, that I was able to recognize because I had seen it almost identically the 1906 earthquake, the story was that the ordinary citizens of New Orleans, mostly poor, mostly black people who did not have the resources to evacuate, had become a kind of violent mob that was terribly dangerous, and that justified essentially locking people in and preventing them from evacuating an 80% flooded city with no electricity, no resources, of portraying every attempt to get vital resources, diapers, food, clean clothing for people who'd swum through toxic water and sewage, as theft and criminality. And the mainstream media were much more excited about the protection of TVs and big chain stores than they were about the rescue of grandmothers on roofs. So there's really this story that New Orleans was this kind of seething mob with grotesque racial overtones. Mm-hmm. And what was actually happening, a lot of the people left behind were single mothers, the elderly, a lot of people, including, you know, young men of color, were doing amazingly altruistic things and, self-organizing. They sent a refrigerated truck for what they assumed was 200 bodies in the Superdome. There were actually six, including a suicide and four natural deaths. And so that they got the story terribly wrong. And we often in this culture think of stories as some kind of recreational entertainment superstructure, but it's foundational, because the real story was that the looters, the panickers, the malicious, destructive people were the institutional authorities regarding these our stranded brothers and sisters as the enemy to be conquered and contained.
Well, as you write, I mean, so the fundamental import of this is that what we believe, as you write, shapes not only how we act or how we can choose to respond, but what we believe about ourselves and about each other.
Absolutely. More than 1,500 people died in Hurricane Katrina, mostly in New Orleans. It probably could have been close to zero if we had operated with more solidarity and less kind of fear and loathing. And so people, and what we're seeing, we're going to see this with this pandemic, in which lack of preparation and distribution of resources will result in a huge amount of death that could have been prevented with another approach, the kind that they've taken in South Korea and Taiwan, for example. So beliefs, we live and die by our beliefs, and never is that more urgent and important than in a disaster.
Well, so then if we live and die by our beliefs, in the American context in particular, Rebecca, I wonder, we see, as you've been talking to us about, we can see the best of ourselves when the moment is extremely urgent. But another thing that we believe, or we're told we should believe about ourselves, is this American myth of rugged individualism, for example. Do we also see in disasters beliefs competing with each other?
We do. In Hurricane Katrina, a lot of people believed the myths about looters and armed themselves. And one of the stories that's just horrific and heartbreaking is about a wonderful young man, Donnell Harrington, who stayed behind to rescue his grandparents and a whole lot of other people, and then in his attempt to evacuate was shot in the back point blank by a white supremacist who assumed all black people were looters and that he had the right to shoot them, you know, or just thought that he could get away with it, which he more or less did. And here was, you know, a heroic person on an evacuation route being treated as a criminal. So you do see that, and LA is sort of dithering about whether to shut down gun shops as essential services. There are people arming themselves because they believe that we're going to have some sort of social Darwinist struggle. But there are also people, and I believe far more people, figuring out how to help each other and really doing extraordinary things. And I'm seeing a lot more of that. You know, one of the things that really impressed me, in the UK, they asked for 200,000 volunteers to help elders who need to shelter in place and really not leave their homes at all. As that country shuts down, they got 400,000 volunteers immediately because people really want to help. And I saw a friend of mine who's 70 try to figure out how, as a photographer, she could do more. And of course, she's in a high-risk group, and there's limits to what she can do. Mm-hmm. But people in these times want to help so much. One of the things that happens in ordinary disasters, maybe not in pandemics, is a kind of convergence. There was a convergence on Lower Manhattan so that they had to barricade it because so many people wanted to bring food, help in so many different ways. And it often becomes a kind of traffic problem of convergence. Yeah. And the Cajun Navy, as it was dubbed, people all around the New Orleans area had to sneak past the authorities to help evacuate people in their own boats, even though they were told that these were terrible, monstrous, dangerous people. But so much of what actually happened to save people from this utterly destroyed city 15 years ago was ordinary people going in there to take their chances and try and pull people off roofs and
right.
freeway overpasses and get them out of there.
So this is a really important point, Rebecca, because as I was reading through your books again, I mean, you've written about, we talked about the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco and subsequent fire. You've also written about the massive explosion in Halifax, Nova Scotia in 1917, the earthquake in Mexico City, written about 9/11 and Katrina. These are all terrible disasters with sort of a fixed period of time and geographic location. I noticed that you didn't write about, in your books at least, about that 1918-1919 flu pandemic. I mean, is there something different about a global pandemic that makes it harder to see what you're arguing is a fundamental truth about human nature, that we are better than we think we are?
It is different because often in disasters you have unaffected people from outside who can come in. And also in a non-medical pandemic, you have, people can connect. In the 06 earthquake and in Katrina, people built community spaces, community kitchens that lasted long after the immediate disaster. People were able to come together physically, and now we have to be apart mm-hmm. physically for safety. But, you saw things like this in World War II, which was not quite a global war. And I did write about the Blitz in London, as all Europe and a lot of the rest of the world was convulsed by war. And I did write in passing about, smallpox pandemics and things, but this is different in scale. And every disaster is a plunge into the unknown for the people experiencing it. We now have a global plunge. And one of the things my partner, who's a doctor, keeps reminding me is that we are in really early stages. And the U.S., at the federal level, I'm proud of my state and my city, but at a federal level has managed and prepared for this really badly. Yeah. But what's going to happen in India, in Brazil, in countries that don't have our resources, in which so many people sheltering in place might mean a dirt floor hovel in which 8 people are living in 2 rooms, maybe without running water and electricity. It's really, we don't know what this is going to look like, but we do know some of the things we can do about it. And we can still mm-hmm. see that human nature rising to the occasion, just that most medical people dealing with this have not abandoned ship to save themselves.
Right. Well, Rebecca,
they are showing up with inadequate equipment often.
Yeah.
Says a lot about who we might be.
So what I really want to ask you then is, do you have hope right now?
I have, and I just find hope as uncertainty with possibilities for positive outcomes. A disaster generally discredits a regime. In ancient China, a disaster was seen as the regime losing the mandate of heaven. I think we're seeing in the U.S., the possibility of profound changes for the better around workers' rights, around universal health care, maybe a basic income, other kinds of distribution of resources. And we're seeing who's callous and selfish and cares more about Wall Street and profit than human life. I don't know yet whether that will result in positive consequences, but I certainly see the possibility. So hopeful, not in the sense of optimistic that we can sit back and wait for all the good stuff to come to us, but hopeful that in this radically destabilized moment, there's always a power struggle, and sometimes we win it if we try really hard.
Well, we're joined this hour by Rebecca Solnit. She's a writer, historian, and activist, and we're talking about hope in the midst of a global pandemic. There's a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to be talking with MIT researcher Sherry Turkle. For years, she's been investigating how technology is actually pushing people socially apart. So we're checking in with her about what she thinks the role technology is playing now, as it's a primary means of keeping people socially connected as we are staying physically apart. So we want to hear from you. What is working for you about online and on screen, about maintaining community that way? Leave us a voicemail with your questions or stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Now, today, we're talking with Rebecca Solnit. She's a writer, historian, and activist, author of more than 20 books. Her most recent book is a memoir called Recollections of My Non-Existence. She's also written about hope in the midst of disasters in several books, and that's what we're focusing on this hour. And we got some voicemails from listeners about why they might be feeling hope, even as we're all struggling together with living with a global pandemic. So here's Jonathan from Lexington, Massachusetts, and he says, this disaster has highlighted disparities, and he hopes more fairness may emerge as a result.
I'm hoping this country becomes more, and the world becomes more economically fair, that there's focus on fairness, because we see how unfair things are and how completely dysfunction of our medical system is. So maybe we'll rebuild a good medical system and have more economic fairness.
So that's Jonathan from Lexington, Massachusetts. And here's what Kaylin from Lee Vining, California, told us about what she hopes might emerge from this disaster.
I've been doing some interviews with staff members such as custodians and dining hall workers from my college for a piece that I'm doing on how these campus closures have affected service workers at colleges. And one of the things that keeps coming up is people feel as if their work is being a lot more appreciated than ever before now. I think it's unfortunate that it takes an event such as this to make people realize that ultimately it is the custodians and the grocery store workers, the public school teachers that keep our nation running. But it's important realization nevertheless. And I have hope that it will last with us after this ends.
That's Kaylin from Lee Vining, California. Now, Rebecca, you know, when Kaylin said, I have hope that this will last after this ends, that's what I really want to explore with you a little bit, because, you know, you've said before that what if we as human beings are better than we think we are, and that if we had a better society or better systems around us, that sort of this more altruistic state that emerges in a disaster would become our default state. I love the idea behind that. I am very emotionally and spiritually and intellectually attracted to that. But I also run into a bit of a barrier, if I could share this with you. And
that is,
you know, you've talked about disasters as this potential backdoor to a paradise, like a human social paradise. But especially in democracies, like, we are all walking through that back door together in a disaster, and then we walk again through it in the other direction when the disaster is over. I just feel like collectively we choose to be our best in urgent moments, and then so frequently we collectively decide that we don't need to be at our best after that, when some sort of sense of normalcy returns. And that's what I wonder, like, will we ever go through that backdoor to paradise in one direction and not backtrack?
You know, that's actually the crucial point that I came to in this book, is like, okay, when everything falls apart, people rise to the occasion. There's a kind of self-forgetfulness, a courage in meeting the demands of the moment. And then a lot of people go home, and it's almost as though this experience, which has often been an extraordinarily positive experience for them, doesn't fit into their sense of who they are, what their society is, and what's possible. But that's not true of everyone. You do see people whose lives are permanently changed and who decide to do something different and better with their lives, something more altruistic, more empathic. But you also see whole societies that say, enough with these, you know, criminals who are running things. Mexico City is the great example, where the callousness and corruption of the Mexican government at the city and federal level in the earthquake, you know, and for that matter of the Nicaraguan government 13 years earlier, when in the 1972 earthquake there in Nicaragua, the response to the disaster, which was a dictatorship becoming more selfish and brutal, hastened the revolution that overthrew it. In Mexico, a lot of positive and permanent social change resulted, which is why I think it's partly about the story we tell. I do think what both of the callers said has real possibility. Will we see great legislation immediately afterwards? Maybe not. We may see more authoritarianism. Will people have a different vision of what's important and necessary? That includes all the people who hold our society together, and responds maybe by working harder for, you know, universal health care, maybe universal basic income, or other kind of justice issues, that quite possibly, and it might take a while for those things to come about. This is also an economic collapse as well as a pandemic. And the 2008 collapse brought on Occupy Wall Street 3 years later, which brought on shed a ton of light on economic inequality, how many people were being devastated by medical, housing, and educational debt, how corrupt the banks were, the need for reform. It brought forth the prominence of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and their visions, which really shaped the Democratic campaign right now. So we're looking 12 years later. You know, if you'd looked 1 year later and said, oh, what came out of the 2008 economic collapse? And, you know, it'd be like, well, a few things changed. So I do think that this is a transformative moment. How and when and who, I cannot answer. We're really early in this. But I do think those callers really were right, that we are seeing what's essential and who matters and who to be grateful to and how we're connected in new ways. A disaster always illuminates how we're connected and how we rely on each other. And it often illuminates selfishness and corruption and callousness too. And we're certainly getting big doses of both of those things. How it will play out so early in this pandemic, when I know that the after effects often take years and years, I cannot say.
Yeah. Well, so we don't know, that's for sure. And especially since this particular kind of disaster, it's been a century since collectively we've all experienced it. But you have studied and talked to and written extensively about other disasters in the intervening 100 years. There have been some outcomes that we can learn from them. haven't there been? I mean, so what lessons would you draw?
Absolutely.
Yeah, what lessons would you
absolutely.
Draw?
Well, one of the things I think is remarkable about 9/11 that I keep saying, because somebody ought to, is that what was clear to me immediately is that the Bush administration was not most frightened by terrorists and regimes in other parts of the world. They were terrified of the response of the American people, which was this kind of open-hearted, open-minded, let's pause everything, think about our foreign policy, think about mortality, think, you know, like the amount of people who tried to give blood, the amount of people who bought books to try and understand our role in the Middle East better. And the Bush administration really wanted to shut that down and make us all scared and obedient and take away our rights. And they did a very good job with that. They fumbled it with Hurricane Katrina, where they lost the power they'd grabbed. And you look at something like Hurricane Katrina, which led to both positive and negative changes locally in New Orleans, but it also exposed at a national level how racist this country was. And some people argue, and I think there's real credence to that argument, made the case for a black president much more pressing and compelling. And so you see these long-term changes that, you know, really matter. But sometimes they're also small and personal.
Yeah.
And how we add them up is subtle. My favorite story I read about the London Blitz, when London was under German bombing in World War II, is a young woman who said that she had felt oppressed and intimidated by her boss for a long time, but she put out an incendiary bomb herself one night and thought, if I can, you know, put out an incendiary bomb, I can tell this man off. And she went and did it. So there's no way to calculate exactly how those things add up, but they do really change people. One of the people who had been in the Nicaraguan earthquake in 1972 said this wonderful thing to me, which is there was a sense that you could lose your life in a single night, which made you willing to risk your life to confront the corruption of the government and maybe become a revolutionary. I do think a lot of the change that matters isn't calculable
yeah.
and quantifiable, but I do think also huge numbers of us are sheltering in place, or whatever we call the staying home and socially distancing. Will we come out of it saying, hey, all that rushing around to buy stuff and do stuff, is that really necessary? Is just human connection face to face the thing we value most?
Right.
Do we not need to produce so much so we can consume so much? Is all this rushing and frenzy that's so environmentally destructive and in some ways so banal necessary? Do we have a different sense of what's important and essential that's going to change our priorities?
Well, you know, Rebecca, I talked about that thread of light on the horizon that hopefully we can all see. For me, that thread of light is that idea of the sort of invisible, incalculable power of a lot of individual change. So that's the hope that I'm going to hold on to after talking to you for this hour.
Well, thank you.
Rebecca Solnit, author of more than 20 books, writer, historian, activist. Her most recent book is a memoir called Recollections of My Non-Existence. And she's also written A Paradise Built in Hell, Hope in the Dark, and Men Explain Things to Me. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
Well, we're going to wrap up the show today with Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, who joins us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Jack, you know, I think Camus is sort of the patron saint of our understanding of this particular global pandemic. And I'm also reminded of something he said, or wrote at least, about how, regarding hope, that he who despairs of the human condition is a coward, but he who has hope for it is a fool. Call me a fool, Jack. Call me a fool.
Call you a fool, indeed. You know, Rebecca's bracing thesis was encapsulated brilliantly by the voicemail from the woman in West Roxbury, and I apologize. I wasn't fast enough with my pen to write down her name.
That was
name,
Andrea. Said, yes, Andrea.
Thank you. But she said disasters lead to moments of what she called forced opportunity. That is brilliant. One such disaster was the American Civil War. Writing right after it, John Stuart Mill saw a moment of forced opportunity. He said, reason and right feeling on any public subject has a better chance of being favorably listened to and finding the national mind open to comprehend it than at any previous time in American history. The great benefit will probably not last out the generation which fought the war, and all depends on making the most of it before the national mind has time to get crusted over with any fresh set of prejudices.
Uh-huh.
That was a plastic moment. And, of course, we know that it was lost. The Civil War, after the Civil War, was a great period of reaction, of racism, of localism, of government, of corruption in government. And the new prejudice which came out was the prejudice to suppress labor on the part of big business and government. So that was a lost moment of forced opportunity. Another moment, another disaster, was the Great Depression, and that was a forced opportunity that was taken advantage of, and that we live in the structure built, bequeathed by the Great Depression, namely Social Security, namely the general idea that government has a responsibility to look after the general welfare, the panoply of regulations for the financial sector. All the reforms were not missed. That moment of forced opportunity was taken advantage of. Will this generation, like the post-Civil War generation, lose the moment and go in the direction of the politics of reaction? Or will it take advantage of the forced opportunity and go in the direction of the politics of remedy? We don't know, and much hangs on that.
Jack, thank you so much. The reminder that we have the choice. I mean, that is the key thing, right? Collectively, as a country, as a society, we have the choice of remedy over reaction. That is what we need to hear and keep at top of mind now. And do you have a thought for us on how we should take this moment and move it forward?
Well, I've got one from George Eliot in Daniel Deronda. It's a passage about history touching our lives. There comes a terrible moment to many souls when the great movements of the world, the larger destinies of mankind, which have lain aloof in newspapers and other neglected reading, enter like an earthquake into their own lives. When the slow urgency of growing generations turns into the tread of an invading army or the dire clash of civil war, then it is that the submission of the soul to the highest is tested, and life looks out from the scene of human struggle with the awful face of duty.
So that's from George Eliot and Daniel Deronda, the earthquake into our own lives. I think that's what so many people are absolutely feeling right now. And the choices that we make thereafter, I think, is going to be how we remember this moment and how we choose to define ourselves. So Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, with us as always from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magda.
And folks, once again, as a reminder, tomorrow we are going to be talking about how we're staying connected and perhaps the better angels of technology. And we'll be talking with Sherry Turkle about that. So if you have a question or a comment about how you're using technology to stay connected, give us a call at 617-353-0683. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amada, Stefano Cotsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim, with help from Caroline Love, Liam Knox, Bradley Noble. Our co-captains are Graham Griffith and Jeb Sharp. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.